Today we have Savannah Dizer, a licensed clinical social worker who's an expert in borderline personality disorder and dialectical behavior therapy. She will share why she focused on BPD and DBT, explaining the unique aspects and how it may help. We'll chat about common challenges for those with BPD and clear up some misconceptions. Also, we will dig into the therapeutic techniques like mindfulness and validation in DBT. We address supporting families, navigating medication, and addressing childhood trauma in therapy. So stay tuned. Welcome back to another episode of The Mindful Space. Today we have with us Savannah Dizer. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Today we are discussing borderline personality disorder and DBT, which is the dialectical behavior therapy. And I know for people that are not in this world of therapy, they're probably like, what the heck is this?
Yeah.
So let's start by telling us, what brought you into this specialty? Why did you go into these specific two things?
You know, it's something that was kind of thrust upon me that I fell into and ended up just falling in love with. I have worked in the treatment world for addiction for quite a while, and BPD happens a lot to co-occur with addiction. So it was something that just kind of popped up on my caseload from here, you know, here and there. And I had the opportunity to get trained in DBT through one of the treatment centers I worked for. And I just really fell in love with it. I thought it was super useful. I loved kind of the skill approach that it had. And I saw it really work with a lot of my clients. So it was something that I didn't intend to go into, but it kind of happened anyways. And I also, you know, talking to other clinicians, BPD is one of those diagnoses that a lot of clinicians consider to be the hardest, or that they intentionally avoid working with because of how difficult the clientele can be or their behaviors can be. And I'm kind of a glutton for punishment. So I like doing the challenging thing. That's always kind of my MO, is to find the thing that's going to be the most challenging and the most exciting. And so after hearing so many people say that they actively avoid working with that diagnosis, I was like, oh, that sounds great. That sounds like me. So I kind of ran toward it after that became clear to me. And then I just fell in love with DBT through the training that I did.
Is DBT like the most commonly used modality for the borderline personality disorder diagnosis?
Yes, absolutely. It's backed now. It's one of the most researched therapies in the world at this point. And it was created specifically to treat borderline personality disorder after they, you know, CBT is kind of the parent therapy. Mm-hmm. And after they were having kind of some failures with CBT with chronically suicidal folks, they're like, we got to try something different, and came up with DBT. And that was found to be much more effective with folks who are chronically suicidal, which are often folks that struggle with borderline personality disorder. So yes, it's definitely the number one therapy used to treat that diagnosis.
For those that not know what BPD might mean, could you give us like a brief description on the diagnosis?
Yeah, so I mean, criteria-wise, I believe you have to meet, what, 5 of the criteria in the DSM for it, which they cover such a wide range, right? It could be anything from just emotional reactivity to struggling with intimacy in relationships, to struggling with a sense of lost identity. I mean, it's such a wide criteria. Anecdotally, what I see a lot of the time is people that really just struggle with feeling their feelings in an appropriate way. They either feel them way too much and are way too reactive with them, or they feel them not at all and completely shut them down and dissociate with them. And because of that, they struggle with relationships, with figuring out who they are, with their value set. And sometimes in order to deal with that, either hyper-emotionality or hypo-emotionality, I don't think that's a word, but we'll see, they engage in some really negative behaviors like self-harm, like suicidality, substance abuse, things of that nature. Eating disorder is another really big one. And so that's typically how they tend to come into our office, on our couch, in our treatment center, is because of an eating disorder, because of a substance abuse issue, one of the behaviors that results from their BPD.
So they come for something else, thinking that it's just that, and then you...
I'd say most often. Yeah, it's most often, oh, I have an addiction, or oh, I have an eating disorder. And then once they sit in front of you long enough, it becomes clear that the eating disorder, the addiction are certainly present and important, yeah. but are symptoms of kind of the bigger core problem of BPD.
Okay. And like you mentioned, you used the dialectical behavior therapy. Can you give us a brief description? We'll get more into it later, but what this modality is, how is it different from CBT, for example?
So really, to boil it down as simply as possible, DBT is CBT plus, weirdly, like a Zen Buddhism kind of mindfulness approach. Okay. That's really what Marsha Linehan, who created it, mixed together to create this therapy. Because it just, we find that with folks that struggle with BPD, there is this need for mindfulness. It treats folks, it is somewhat prescriptive. You are kind of intended to follow it in a certain way. And it treats folks in four kind of key areas, or they're called modules in the therapy. Mindfulness, emotion regulation, distress tolerance, and interpersonal effectiveness, which are four areas that folks struggle with yeah. BPD. So that's kind of what it looks like, is these kind of four different areas with four different skill sets that you're intended to follow. I think that it's changed over time what order you do them in, but you know, I think at the core of all of it is mindfulness.
Okay. You would say that's like the top one.
I think so, and I think mostly opinion. I don't know that that's as much research based as it is just my experience and opinion and working with it. Because to me, you can't do those other three things. You can't communicate effectively, and you can't tolerate distress if you aren't first mindful and present and aware of your surroundings. Yeah. So, to me, if you don't conquer the mindfulness piece first, it's really, really tough to do any of these other pieces.
Is it tough to get the mindfulness out of certain clients sometimes?
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, I talk a lot with my BPD clients in the first session about the window of tolerance, right? And that's, to me, what DBT is about, is making your window of tolerance bigger. We all have one. It's just folks with BPD maybe are born with a much smaller one than other folks. And when you go out of your window of tolerance on the top side, you are over-regulated, hyper-aroused, or I'm sorry, under-regulated. And then if you go under that window of tolerance, you start to dissociate. So meaning when I experience stress, if I fall up here, I'm going to become hyper-reactive. If I fall down here, I'm going to completely shut down and just disconnect from the world. And so you need mindfulness first so that you can do any work at all, because I can't work on my emotions if I'm completely dysregulated or if I'm completely shut down. I first have to learn how to kind of live in this window. And then to me, all those other skills sort of lengthen the window, or widen the window, I guess is probably the right word. So, yeah.
No, I mean, I can totally see how that theory works. I completely agree with you. Yeah. Mindfulness is key. How do you help, or how can you help them, at least in the first couple of sessions? How do you go about that?
I think one of the very first skills I do from kind of the mindfulness module is the rest skill. And that's an acronym you'll find if you ever look into DBT. There's like 10,000 acronyms. It's a big acronym therapy, which I think is good because it's something that sticks in your mind. But one of the first ones I give that kind of builds immediate mindfulness is REST, which stands for relax, evaluate, set an intention, and take action. And that's something I've seen in that first session gives people actually a lot of relief very quickly, just to practice this. Okay, when I'm confronted with something that's overwhelming, how do I take a second to relax? Take a deep breath, think it through for a moment, you know, go to my happy place, whatever that looks like for them. How do I evaluate what my options are? So I could punch a wall right now, I could punch somebody in the face, or I could sit down and take a few deep breaths or use some other kind of coping skill that's worked for me, a journal, whatever. How do I set an intention? So pick one of those options and then take action and actually follow through with the thing that I say I'm going to do. It sounds really simple, but and it's something that those of us that don't struggle as much with regulation, we do it. We don't even think about it. That's just how we exist. But for folks with BPD, that doesn't come naturally. It's all impulse. There's no awareness of making a decision. So I love that kind of initial skill to give people, to give that right away relief to them.
It's almost like learning how to recognize, well, take a step back and really see the problem or whatever, the situation happening from an outsider instead of just being inside with your emotions.
Exactly. And right now, your emotions are visitors, right? They're not who you are. They're just visitors passing through your house. lives, as I like to say.
They're just very uncomfortable, but
yes, very.
Let it pass by. Can you explain for us a little bit the importance of BPD from a therapeutic perspective, like how different it is from, I don't know what other disorder would compare to it, but why is it important to talk about BPD?
Well, it's, for one thing, going back to what we were talking about earlier, I think it gets missed a lot, right? We focus on putting out the fires that BPD causes instead of actually acknowledging the core BPD that's going on. So that's an important piece of why we have to talk about it and why we have to research it and understand it, because otherwise we're going to spend all this time putting out the addiction, and then the whack-a-mole eating disorder comes out, and then we put down the eating disorder, and the sex addiction comes out, right? Like, we'll always find another issue if we don't actually treat the core problem. I think one of the reasons clinicians struggle with BPD is because there's not really this agreed upon cause or solution for it. It's kind of one of those mysteries of the therapeutic world that we can't point to a brain chemistry imbalance or, you know, yes, sometimes people will make the argument it's caused by trauma, but not always, right? There's plenty of people that struggle with BPD that don't have trauma, not a lot, but there are some. So you can't point to one trauma or one imbalance in the brain that causes this disorder. And that can be really frustrating because there's not a clear direction.
Like a guide.
Yes. Yeah. You just kind of have to ride the wave of it. But that's why I love treating it so much, because I think we have to go through the process with them in a way. The same way they get frustrated and they have setbacks and then progress, we have that too. We'll have a great session with them and they're, you know, not engaging in binging and restricting, or they're not engaging in drinking, and then the next session they come back and they've had the setback, and we take a setback with them, and it's kind of exhausting at times, which is why I think a lot of people avoid working with it. But we have to acknowledge that core issue, and we have to kind of accept that there isn't going to be this magic bullet that fixes this disorder the way that maybe some folks view, you know, depression or anxiety. Oh, I take this medication and maybe a few months of therapy and I'm good to go and it's in remission. BPD's not that straightforward.
So it's treatable or manageable, or how would you categorize
it? Yeah, I would, to me, I know I just said it about depression and anxiety, but I think it's similar to, you know, other medical diseases where you put it in remission, but it's never really gone. You're never cured of BPD. You're never really cured of a lot of mental illnesses, but you can learn the skills that you need to manage it on a daily basis and not allow it to impair your functioning. And so that's really, to me, that's the goal, is how do I learn to live with this and learn how to manage it rather than cure it or get rid of it?
Yeah. It's almost like living with trauma, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Which happens a lot.
When we talk about the BPD, I know we went over a little bit of what it is, but can you go into maybe some of the key symptoms that you see in your clients?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the biggest symptom is that either dissociation or that complete emotion dysregulation and reactivity. They see it in their everyday lives and their problems with their relationships. A lot of the time they struggle with forming any kind of healthy relationships. Either they're in unhealthy relationships or they're in healthy relationships that they're actively sabotaging with their behaviors. So a lot of the time they come in because they're struggling with a relationship. A lot of the time they come in because they're having a hard time staying present and being able to feel feelings in a healthy way. Like I said earlier, a lot of the time they come in for the other kind of offshoot issues, like the eating disorders, like the self-harm behaviors.
Yeah, the more obvious ones.
Yeah, the more out there and loud things. But I think a lot of the time the core giveaway, so to speak, for me is, you know, I ask them about who they are and what's important to them, and they have a really hard time identifying that and answering
their values.
Their core beliefs. They have a very hard time even knowing what that means, right? Like, what does it mean to know who you are? Because that's such a foreign concept to have a solid identity. A lot of the time they get their identity from their relationships, right? Oh, I'm a mother. Oh, I'm a dad. I'm a brother. Okay. I'm a, you know, soldier, right? I'm all of these things to other people, but they don't actually have an identity of their own that they can cling to, and they don't know what's important to them. They just base all of that off of making other people happy.
Okay. So it's almost like a codependency with the relationship, yeah, or whatever role they play,
right,
in their lives.
And it's very nerve-wracking as a therapist sometimes, because they'll place a lot of importance and really place their whole life into a romantic relationship or parental relationship or something like that. And when that relationship either takes a setback, crumbles, you know, dissipates, I mean, they really go through it. They really struggle. It's not like they're able to see themselves separate from those relationships. Mm-hmm. That relationship is
that was
who they
their
are.
Identity.
Yes. So that's where we see kind of some of those more dangerous behaviors come out a lot of the time.
When you use, so they're presenting all of this. Imagine, you know, they break up a relationship, they're going through it. Mm-hmm. How does DBT come into place? What are some of the key factors that makes this like the best therapeutic modality for this disorder?
I think that, you know, if I were to sum up both what DBT is and what folks with BPT or BBD, oh my gosh, BPD need in their lives, that word is balance, right? That's really what they need, is finding that window of tolerance, being able to stay in a balanced place without living like this all the time. And that's what DBT is. Getting all my things messed up. That's what DBT is all about, is finding balance. You know, finding balance. It's called dialectical behavior therapy, and a dialectic is finding synthesis between two opposites. So there are several kind of core dialectics that DBT is built on, but my favorite and probably the most important one is acceptance and change. So when somebody goes through something really difficult, like a relationship breakup, or, you know, God forbid, a parent dying, something like that, that's really going to shake them to their core, it's how do we practice acceptance of what's happened and learn to move forward with it and create change at the same time, which is, you know, the reason, again, I love this therapy so much is because I think we all do that every day,
yes,
is learn how to balance out acceptance and change, learn how to balance out, you know, intervention, consultation, some of these other core dialectics.
But it makes complete sense. I have a friend that always says accept and embrace.
Yeah.
But it's easier said than done, right? When you're not going through a challenging
episode
or a situation in your life, it's, you know, you can tell anybody, like, just accept it, it's fine. But,
right,
like, how do we really get to start that process of accepting something that we don't want to
We didn't ask for and we didn't want. And I think it's important to remember that, like, we can't just accept either, right? Like, that's why there's another half. There's the dialectic. It's because if we just sat here and accepted every crappy thing that happened to us, we'd have a pretty not worth living life. It'd be really difficult to live that way if we were just like, go with the flow, let anything happen. You'd be a doormat. So how do I accept the things that I need to accept, but then also make changes where I'm capable of making changes, which is not everywhere, right? There are some times when we just have to lean on the acceptance piece. But, you know, if, let's say you're going through a divorce, if you just sat in acceptance and just sat and cried all day, you wouldn't accomplish anything. You got to go out there and you've got to, you know, find a lawyer. You've got to connect with your friends. You've got to look for, you know, places to live. You got to worry about custody. Like, there's things that you've got to do in that situation, but you also have to leave room for accepting your feelings where they are. And it's a difficult kind of balance to strike.
It is. I mean, for some people it is.
Yeah.
Like you said, some of us just go through these things every day. Oh, that happened. Yeah. Okay, whatever. I'm going to do this.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Just go into action. But for people with BPD,
it's like insurmountably difficult to do.
Wait, what do you mean change?
Yeah.
Change what?
Yes.
From a therapeutic standpoint, and we talked about mindfulness, but how do you incorporate it into your clients? Like, maybe is there a technique for listeners that can, you know, start doing today?
I mean, it's the tried and true old one, but I love the box breathing, the square breathing. I really believe that mindfulness for a lot of folks has to, especially folks with BPD, it has to start in your body, because your thoughts and feelings are so overwhelming when you struggle with this diagnosis that your body doesn't lie, right? There's the famous body keeps the score and all that. So I believe that your body is not capable of being disingenuous. Your body is always going to be honest about where you're at. And so because of that, I love the breathing techniques, and I specifically love body scan meditations, which you can find on YouTube, on Spotify, on the Calm app, not to plug them, sorry. But there's all sorts of apps and YouTube videos where you can do a body scan meditation where it takes you through, like, okay, focus in on the crown of your head and what sensations you feel there, now into your shoulders and into your tips of your fingers. And it forces you to connect with your body and be present in this body that you have. And from there, you can start to practice more of the emotion and thought-based meditations, your classic kind of guided meditations. But I find the body scan is a really good place to start.
Yeah, especially if you're not used to meditation, having like a guided one.
Exactly.
It does make the difference. Because if not, you're just sitting there with your thoughts.
Yeah, exactly.
You're trying to not avoid, but like take a break and be present. Right. And you're just like, okay, what do I do now?
Yes.
How do you navigate the, I don't want to say difficult, but like, delicate balance between acceptance and change and the concept of BPD, the one we were just talking about.
It's, God, that's the golden question, isn't it? I think it's going to be client by client, and not even client by client. It's going to be session by session, depending on what that person brings to me that day, which one we're going to lean a little bit more into. Mm-hmm. I believe there's four modules, and they kind of fall into acceptance and change. So the acceptance modules are mindfulness and distress tolerance, I believe. And then the change modules are emotion regulation and interpersonal effectiveness. So if we're sensing they're having a harder time with relationships and they're like dying to make changes and they want to work on how they communicate, we're going to lean more into change. We're going to lean on giving them skills and practicing something that, you know, they can take home with them and use in their relationships. But if they're feeling stuck and they're feeling like, I can't activate anything new, nothing's working, that's something here all the time, we're going to lean a little more into acceptance and practice some more mindfulness and kind of go back to basics and just be okay with wherever you're at, right? That sensation of nothing's working just creates more nothing's working, right? It just creates more of that same defeated feeling. And so we have to learn how to separate from that feeling and just see it for what it is and accept, okay, I'm feeling like nothing's working right now. I'm having this kind of defeated thought. Mm-hmm. It'll pass.
Yeah, it doesn't mean this is who I am, or like it's going to be.
It's not a fact, it's just a feeling, right?
Yeah,
it's not going to be like that forever. Today, my skills aren't working. I always try to get them to be present, right? Rather than none of this ever works and none of it's ever going to work. It's okay, today it's not working. Let's try something else, or let's try nothing and let's just be present and vent about it and accept it for what it is, if that's what you need on that day.
And it's so important. It almost reminds me of CBT. Well, it comes from one negative thought can have such a big impact, and sometimes we don't even think about it.
Yes.
And we are our worst self-critics.
Oh, of course.
Because I mean, I know I'm guilty of it.
We all just think
the worst.
They're all gonna overlap, right? Like I've done CBT trainings, DBT trainings, ACT all these different TTTs, all these T trainings. And they all overlap. They're all similar. I use so much of the ACT language in my DBT work. And, of course, you're going to see a lot of the thought, feeling, behavior type of progression in DBT that's born from CBT. So, yes, there's always going to be overlap. And to me, that's a good thing that they all work together and they can all kind of be blended together to whatever that person resonates with.
I know a lot of therapists that specialize in like one thing, but they end up using a lot of different modalities.
Yes.
And I think that would be the best because not one client is the same, right?
Yeah.
So what might work for you might not work for somebody else.
Especially if something's, you know, a lot of the time when you're working with someone who has BPD, it's a long process. You're with them for a long time and you can only say the same skills so many times. So when maybe some of the core DBT stuff starts to get stale, I'll infuse a little bit of ACT work in there. And to me, it complements so beautifully. That's one of my favorite kind of pairings to put together. And that kind of reinvigorates kind of the practice and helps them connect with the skills in a new way. So yeah, I love mixing together different things with DBT.
Same. That's amazing. For, I don't want to say new therapists, but for therapists that might have new clients.
Yeah.
The ones that are scared to take the borderline personality disorder clients, what would be an advice for them? What can you recommend?
Oh my gosh, my advice is take them, do it. No, they need help, right? I think it's important to normalize that folks with BPD struggle with very normal everyday challenges that we face, and we just face them a little easier. We face them with a little less difficulty. They're not doing these, I think a common brand that gets stuck on BPD folks is like, oh, attention-seeking behavior.
Okay.
And they're doing something to get attention. And I really try to go away from that language as much as possible, because that's really not what it's about at the core. Those behaviors are a cry for help a lot of the time, and they are helping that person have their needs met in some way, or it's helping them feel better in some way. And so rather than brand them as attention seeking, we can just look at them, man, you're really struggling and this is helping you in this moment, even if it's something really horrible and dangerous, like an eating disorder or like a self-harm behavior. There's something about that that's helping them. And so before we can judge them and challenge them on it, we have to first just honor that behavior for what it is, obviously in a safe way, to say, okay, what is the function of this? What it, you know, we have to look at folks with BPD as whole people that are doing things with intention and not just trying to make your job difficult. That's really not what they're about. They're just trying to get help and they're doing the best that they can. Yeah. I always have to kind of keep that at the forefront, that ultimately, no matter how maybe exhausted I am by this case or how stuck I'm feeling, this person is doing the best that they can. And so I have to do the best I can to help them too.
Yeah, no, that's, you nailed it. I find that a lot of people also, maybe not confused, but because of this whole stigma, they're seeking attention, then they're like, oh, they're narcissistic.
Yeah, I hate that word so much. I talk about it all the time because people always come in, my husband's a narcissist, my mom's a narcissist. We can use it as a little n, but we're not going to slap that label on everyone.
That's a full diagnosis.
Yeah, there's a criteria there that is
not
being met. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it goes back to the stigma.
Yeah.
Right?
It really does.
The same with BPD.
It really does. It's, and a lot of people are quick to slap that label on people, too. And I really do believe that at different points in everyone's life, you can meet one criteria or two of BPD. Uh-huh. I mean, when you look at the criteria, they're very normal human experiences, difficulty with relationships, difficulty encountering your feelings. These are not the right language, but difficulty dealing with your feelings. We all struggle with those things.
Of course.
We just don't all struggle with them at the same time. And that's the difference, right? So I think it's, we have to humble ourselves to realize that folks that have this diagnosis are dealing, again, with everyday problems that we encounter, maybe on a daily basis. We just encounter them less severely, less often, and less cumulatively.
How do you think as a community or friends and family, like how we can lower that stigma percentage, or like when we talk about borderline personality disorder?
I think it's a lot about, well, first, if you're a family member, a friend, something, or even a therapist working with someone with BPD, the most important thing, I think, is having good boundaries. The kind of analogy or the metaphor that I was told by my clinical supervisor back when I was an intern, and that I now share all the time, is that folks with BPD, not maliciously, but they have a lot of energy, and when they interact with you, they're trying to give that energy to you and pass it off to you because it's too much for them to hold. And so it's like, let me bounce this ball of energy over to you, and I'm going to walk away feeling even better from the conversation, but the person I've now talked to is feeling sunken and exhausted. And that's why boundaries are so important, right? When they bounce the ball to us, we have to say, okay, and just be that mirror and be the reflection and just bounce it right back to you, right? Rather than hold all of that energy for them, which sometimes we're tempted to do when we have positive countertransference with folks. I want to help you. I want to hold all of this for you, but I have to set that boundary. It's like, no, this is your journey. This is your success and your failure, not mine, but I'm here to help you along the way. So whether you're a clinician, a family member, a friend, it's really important to hold good, healthy boundaries with folks that struggle with BPD. And they may not like it all the time, but it really is what's best to help them work through their feelings rather than do the easy thing, which is to just give those feelings to you to deal with.
Can you give us maybe a particular example that you can think of what might a client with BPD say or ask or project to somebody else and how we can establish that boundary?
So I think that immediately what comes to mind from working in the treatment world, right, which maybe isn't applicable to everyone, but when my early BPD clients, you know, when they were upset about something, they didn't know how to discharge that anger. Let's say they really wanted a phone call home that night and it wasn't their phone call night. I have to hold that boundary when they would come to me I mean, literally screaming, yelling, banging on the door, throwing themselves on the floor because they're so dysregulated, rather than completely shut them out and just like screw you, which is going to make them even more dysregulated, and rather than feed into that and escalate with them, because that's them giving me the ball of energy and me leaving the conversation feeling even more exhausted, I have to just be kind of neutral with them. And you know, it's not your phone call night, and I know that that really upsets you, but you will have a phone call tomorrow, and it's going to be okay, and you're going to make it through tonight. What can you do tonight to make it through so that you can be safe and be comfortable tonight while you wait for your phone call? And if they're not ready to hear that, it's okay. You're not ready to talk about it right now. Why don't you go take a few deep breaths, come back, we'll talk about it then, and hopefully you'll be in a better place, right? Part of being mindful is knowing when the other person's mindful too. So it's like, if I know that this is not going to go anywhere, I have to end this conversation. Okay. But I have to do it in a balanced way rather than a like slam the door in their face type of way. So to me, the boundary is just being calm, holding firm to whatever the expectation is. Hey, it's not okay for you to talk to me that way. Hey, it's not your phone call night, whatever the situation is. And not allowing them to place all that energy on you and kind of drag you with them into the dysregulation and the chaos that's going on within them.
And I can't imagine when you mix it with substance abuse, like treatment centers or family members, when they come, you know, asking for money.
Yes.
You know, things like that. I'm sure it could escalate very quickly.
Oh, absolutely. People don't like boundaries. We don't like them when we've had this much room and then all of a sudden someone puts us in a box. This box is big. We're not going to enjoy that. And so when I was working with families a lot more, that was always kind of what I coached them through. It's like, you're going to set this boundary. They are not going to like it. Like, they are going to call you every name in the book, and they're going to try as hard as they can to find the button that gets rid of this boundary. Yeah. You have to hold firm, and even if that means ending the conversation, because you have to do what's right for you. If it's causing so much emotional distress that now the ball of energy is with you, we have to bounce it back, and we have to walk away from the conversation. And ultimately, they're the ones that are going to have to learn how to deal with that at the end of the day.
Exactly. I say the same thing. Even if you're not working with the whole family, just working with one person.
Yes.
And you're teaching them how to create boundaries. You're like, well, what's going to happen? I'm like, well, the beginning, everything's going to be really bad.
Yeah, it's not going to be pretty.
Nobody's going to like it. Yeah. You're going to be, you know, this horrible person, human being. They're going to throw everything they can at you. Mm-hmm. But you're a family, but you have to do this for me. Or whatever.
Right.
Just expect it.
It's like, part of the process.
Don't take it personal. Yeah, like, you're the one changing the whole system.
Yep,
like,
and it only takes one. It takes one person to change the system.
So, you know, they get a little scared. It's like, oh, but what if they get into a fight? And I was like, it's their, you know, however they're going to deal with it. It's not you.
Not your responsibility their reaction is not your responsibility. Mm-hmm. Your responsibility is just to set the boundary and be honest and straightforward.
Yeah. And it's so hard, especially, you know, if we start talking about different cultures.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Setting boundaries is not okay with your family.
No, definitely not.
It's a whole other.
Yes, that's episode. There's a whole other podcast. Yeah.
What would be your some of the recommendations or effective strategies to help support the family members and friends that have a BPD family member or coworker or whatever, that they have to deal with someone with that diagnosis?
I really think having your own therapist who's versed in this diagnosis and in treating it can be helpful, because they can help you figure out what boundaries are going to be most effective. They can help you practice your own mindfulness skills, your own distress tolerance skills, and also help you just understand this disorder aside from kind of the stigma and the pop psychology-ness of it. Having a professional actually sit down and go through with you, like, this is what this diagnosis means and this is what your loved one is going through, will also just help you have empathy for them. Because a lot of the time, I mean, it's similar to addiction, right? You just see the really ugly parts and you just see those really negative behaviors that really hurt you, and you don't really see the actual diagnosis and the actual issue that is causing those things, right? It's not that Bobby is hurting Karen, it's that this diagnosis is hurting Bobby and Karen, right? You guys are ultimately in this together, you know, fighting this diagnosis and fighting this acute problem, rather than the actual person, right? BPD is not who they are. It's just part of who they are that's causing a lot of issues in your relationship with them. So I think educating yourself, learning how to set boundaries, even getting your own therapist, your own support, can really help you to, like, build that empathy and use your own skills in how you deal with them.
I think that's a wonderful advice to get your own therapist to deal with that. Maybe get some psychoeducation to really understand if you're actively, you know, trying to be there for them.
Right.
That's very important. Now, how can... Okay. Medication. I know that's a big debate.
Yeah.
What do you think about medication for a borderline personality disorder diagnosis?
So there is no medication for borderline personality. There is no, like... Prozac for borderline. Yeah. That's not a thing. There's no one medication. That being said, borderline can co-occur with a lot of different things. It can co-occur with anxiety, depression, these other things that can be medicated. So I've got plenty of folks that struggle with BPD that take antidepressants or take anxiolytics, but it's not to treat the borderline. It's to treat maybe something co-occurring or to treat the anxiety that comes along with living with borderline personality disorder. I always, and I mean, this is for everyone in my practice personally, just coming from a treating addiction background, I always kind of lead people away from addictive medications, period. Even if they're prescribed, they can be addictive. It's not good for your body. It's not good for your brain. But non-addictive medications can help with some of the like offshoot symptoms or some other co-occurring things. But there's no medication designed for any personality disorder. That's not how it works. There's no imbalance to be treated. There's no physical malady to be treated. It is a personality disorder. So it's not really something that can be medicated.
And you mentioned that most of the cases come due to trauma, or what would you say is like the main...
I think, which it falls in line with borderline, I think they come in not knowing what they're coming in for, right? Which is so, you know, it's fitting for folks that don't know who they are and don't know really how to handle their feelings. A lot of the time, they come in saying, I just need help. I don't know what's happening. My life is unmanageable, either because of poor relationships, addiction, other behaviors. So I'd say most people just come in saying, like, help me. And they don't really know what's going on.
Okay.
That or kind of a dead giveaway on paper to me is when somebody comes in with like 47,000 diagnoses. They're like, I have OCD, I have anxiety, I have PTSD, I have this, I have that, I have blah, 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 blah. That's when I'm like, do you actually have all those things? Or do you have this one big thing that looks like all of these things? Because BPD can look like all of those different things. And so typically people either will come in for a laundry list of things or they'll come in saying, I've got no idea why I'm here. I just need help.
Let me see that 50 list. No, you got one thing.
Every time I see a long list, I'm like,
Well, it's also not talked about a lot. Like you hear the anxiety, depression, again, terms that are being lightly used, like a narcissist, but not a lot of people talk about BPD. So nobody really knows. And like you said, it's one of those diagnoses that
it's not super clear cut.
It's complicated to diagnose.
And everyone really looks different too, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a lot. I think a lot of clinicians are hesitant to like put a label that's so stigmatized on people. Yeah. But weirdly, I think that owning that label and just putting it out there destigmatizes it, right? When I can come to someone and say, like, you know, have you ever heard of this? You fit some of these criteria. How do you feel about that? It's a risk. Sometimes they really don't like being put with a label, but I think that's what helps destigmatize it is just acknowledging that it exists and that it's a normal thing to live with.
Do you think a lot of people use their diagnosis as like a clutch? It's like, okay, well now I have personality disorder and then that's going to be their excuse. We're like, well, it's not me. It's the BPD.
It's, that is another one of the really difficult pieces because folks with BPD struggle with identity. When you give them a label like that, that's now who I am. That is the reason I do everything that I do. This is an excuse for why I engage in really negative behaviors. It's an excuse for why I, you know, harm people that are close to me. It's an explanation. It's not an excuse. And there's, to me, such a key difference there. But you do have to be very mindful and kind of monitor for that kind of clutching to it behavior. Because, it's not... they're not doing it malintended or anything like that. It's just part of the course of the diagnosis is that I'm given a label and I'm going to run with it and it's going to be who I am.
Great. I came here to find myself. I'm BPD. I am done.
Right. Exactly.
Thank you, therapist.
Yes.
Another term that people use a lot is the high functioning, right? And sometimes it could be applied to individuals with BPD who appear... successful in their professional lives. Right. Maybe they do have an okay relationship. Mm-hmm. So how do you think this label is helpful or potentially misleading, and how does it impact treatment?
You know, it's not a label I use really ever with any diagnosis, because I don't want to create like a caste system or a hierarchy of a diagnosis. If you've got it, you've got it. You work to deal with it. To me, what I imagine is that the high-functioning folks are just the folks that have either been treated for it or have found their own way of managing it and putting it into remission, like we were talking about earlier.
Okay.
I don't think it hurts necessarily, but I don't think it helps either. And so there's no purpose to me of using that kind of language when it doesn't contribute anything to the treatment or to the course of, you know, the recovery. It's just kind of a...
like you're managing.
Yeah, like a thrown out kind of phrase that to me just means I'm doing a good job at managing this. I've got the skills that I need to function every day.
Yeah, because that mean at the end of the day, that's what therapy's for, right? To get the skills that you need in order to be high functioning.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So, yeah, no, I completely agree with you. When we talk about, again, the DBT, the therapeutic modality into the BPD, how long does this treatment take? Or what's your usual amount of therapy? Is everybody different? Do you say like 6 months you'll be able to have these tools? And
oof, that is a tough, I mean, it really depends on the acuity that's going on, the type of behaviors that are going on. You get some folks that come in for outpatient therapy, but they're super high risk for suicide or for really dangerous self-harm behaviors. Those kind of folks need inpatient treatment a lot of the time, and so I'll refer them to a higher level of care. Some folks come in and are high functioning. No, some folks come in and are managing it somewhat okay, and they may need, you know, a couple sessions a week for a few months, and then they can kind of start to scaffold it back. I would say most folks that have come through kind of my couch that struggle with BPD and want that work, they usually want 2 sessions a week, which is quite a lot for outpatient. Yeah. But they really benefit from that constant kind of support. Okay. And to be fair, true DBT is being available essentially 24/7 to your clients,
really?
Which I don't do, and I don't, not too many folks that practice DBT do like full on 24/7 availability. The reason for that is so that they can reach out and get what's called coaching, phone coaching, where they can call you and say like, I'm really wanting to, you know, maybe purge my food tonight and I'm struggling, help me with some skills. And you can say, hey, have you tried rest? Have you tried, you know, Dear Man, which is interpersonal optimist, that would need to be applicable. But, you know, have you tried this skill, that skill? Call me back, let me know how it goes. So you're supposed to be available to them at all times.
That just reminds me of, you know, when it comes to addiction, like having a sponsor.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Right?
And it's just, that's why folks that do true, buy the book, Linehan DBT, they have such tiny practices because they see their people like daily, and they talk to them daily. And so they can't like afford the time to take on more than a few people. That's where I think the mixing and the blending with other therapies can be helpful, because, you know, I'm not available to do phone coaching. I tell my clients that they're allowed to text me a few times a week if they need a check-in really quickly, just a few words of encouragement. Okay. And that's kind of the adjustment that I made. Yeah. But I'm not a crisis center, right? And that's super clear. If you're coming into our outpatient treatment, at least in my practice, I'm not a crisis center. You can't call me and say I'm suicidal. I'm going to call the police to have you assessed.
Yeah.
So I very carefully assess folks that come in wanting kind of DBT treatment and make sure that they're actually going to be appropriate for the level of care that I can give them. And if they're not, we'll refer them out. But length of time-wise, to get back to your original question, it really depends. I think a lot of the time, you know, in the course of finding themselves and finding what a healthy relationship looks like, they do really latch on to you once you've built that rapport, and they do really, you know, find a lot of solace in you as their therapist. And so they stick around for a long time, and they do want to just do checkups maybe later down the road where they only see you every couple of weeks or once a month. So they, you know, I usually let them stick around as long as they feel like it's useful to them and as long as I feel like we're accomplishing something.
Because at one point, wouldn't you, I guess the original thing that we get taught is don't let people depend on you.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's a tough balance for sure.
Yeah. So if you're here trying to coach them or available 24/7, like, how do you know that they're like ready to just be on their own?
I think you just have to like scaffold it out and hey, you know, I know we've been going 6 months, two times a week. Maybe let's try once a week and see how you do once a week. And if you're really struggling, we can add it back on, but I'm not going to be here forever. Right. I happen to work from the attachment perspective a lot too. And so I do think it's okay to be a healthy attachment for a client if they've not had that before.
Yeah.
But my goal is not to be a healthy attachment for them forever. My goal is to show them what that can look like so that they can then duplicate it in their outside lives. So if I sense that I'm the only one still, and we've been at this for a year or 2 years, now we have to start maybe exploring, hey, you know, who else in your life feels safe and supportive to you? And how can we like start to step away, not necessarily terminate? Yeah. And the last thing you want to do with someone with BPD is simulate abandonment. That's one of the core fears of someone with BPD. So how do I do that in a supportive way of like, I'm still here with you and I want you to have that kind of relationship elsewhere too.
So important. It's so difficult.
Yeah, it's a tough balance. But that's, like I said earlier, the reason I love this is we go through it with them. We're finding the balance just like they're finding the balance.
No, I loved it. Now I'm interested. I mean, like you said, it's always been a big taboo in the clinical world. Mm-hmm. You know, like I know people that avoid certain diagnoses. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, there's people like you that are specifically trained for these kind of things that we can refer, right?
Yeah, right. Because it does happen where a lot of folks say, like, I just can't handle it. I can't give them what they need. Yeah. Bring them my way. That's fine. No. So, yeah, if you're not comfortable with, you know, I always say take them, do it, you know, take people. But at the same time, if you know that there's going to be too much transference, countertransference, there's going to be too much, you know, acuity for you to cope with as a therapist, it's okay to refer out. There are people out here who are trained in modalities that help. Yeah, and it's you, at the end of the day, it's what's best for the client. If you're not what's best for the client, we need to find someone that is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's another stigma, right? Like, it's okay not to be the right therapist for every client.
I tell every client that very early on that, like, hey,
we're not
if it's with us, if it's this, great. Mm-hmm. And if it's not, great too. We'll find someone who is. I know lots of great therapists, and we will cross that bridge if we have to. And I think it takes the pressure off of, because I've had so many people that, you know, are a few months in, and they come back like 6 months into the process and they're like, oh my God, those first few weeks, I like did not think we were working. And I'm like, why didn't you tell me? We could have worked something out. So, you know, I always encourage people, you don't have to be afraid to tell me this isn't working or I don't know if we're a right fit. I will help you even if you hate my guts. I'll help you find someone. That's my job as a therapist and my obligation ethically is to help you find someone who is a right fit, even if it's not me.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I love this conversation. We keep talking and keep going out of the
the rabbit holes.
Yeah, but I think we hit the